Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. Dante Chinney is our guest this hour. It's been a while since we chatted with Dante, and he has a lot to talk about. What did we learn from the primary in Wisconsin? We will discuss that. He wrote a very interesting piece recently on health care's effect on the 2012 vote, something I've been thinking about since the Supreme Court did deliberations on this. Was it last week? It seems like it was yesterday, but I think it was last week. So his piece asks about the issue's impact in 2012, and he says it's complicated. The Obama plan aims at extending coverage, and you might imagine that as you walk up that scale of uninsured in his chart of the patchwork nation, support for the plan would grow, but the polls indicate that's not exactly correct. So we will talk with Dante about that and a number of other issues. He's a journalist. He's author of Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. Dante has been a journalist for two decades. He's worked at Newsweek, the Christian Science Monitor, and the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He works on exploring the country through the lens of 12 community types of Patchwork Nation. This is a project that he invented and the Knight Foundation has funded. The project is the focus of Our Patchwork Nation, which was released in 2010. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dante on a variety of topics. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Hour two of our program, we will celebrate in great style National Poetry Month. Dante Chinney, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So what did we learn from the Wisconsin primary, sir?
Well, I think, you know, everybody's saying, is it over? Everybody's asking, is it over?
Right.
Is the race over? It's pretty close. I think at this point it's a question of whether Santorum wants to stretch things out for another couple months maybe. But we're pretty much at the end here. The thing that was really noticeable, and you can see it actually on the website we have on patchworknation.org, you can look at what happened in these different types of county in Wisconsin. You guys have, you know, you have the area around Milwaukee and those kind of wealthy suburban areas around Milwaukee. Those places went pretty strongly for Romney, as those places have really in every state. He's won the big cities, what we call the industrial metropolis, and these places, these suburban areas, we call the moneyed burbs. He's won those places pretty much everywhere, or in the vast majority of states anyway. But Santorum had done very well in these small town communities we call service worker centers and these aging communities we call emptying nests. Even in the states he lost, Santorum did pretty well in those places. He won them by 9 points, each of them, the emptying nest and the service worker centers in Illinois, even as he lost the state. But something very interesting happened Tuesday night. Romney did not win those communities, did not win those county types, but he got very close. He lost them only by 2 or 3 percentage points. And to me, that suggests that conservatives and, you know, maybe social conservatives and people at the lower end of the income scale with whom Romney has really struggled may be starting to come around to him.
I was amazed, though, how well Santorum did in this state, considering the fact that Romney had oodles and oodles and oodles of money.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, Santorum's, what's really happened so far, what's kept Santorum afloat is just this, whatever money Romney has, there's just been this residual, I don't want to say, maybe not residual, but there's been this ongoing distrust from some parts of the Republican Party about Romney, and it, you know, he couldn't spend his way out of it. But it, as well as Santorum did, and you're right, he did do pretty well. In fact, it's really interesting. Santorum did very well in Dane County, which makes absolutely no sense when you think about it. Because that's, you know, that's home of Madison, and you would think that's a fairly liberal area of the state. Even the Republicans there, you would think, wouldn't be big Santorum fans. But I think what really happened there is you had a little bit of mischief-making.
Oh, I think you're right.
From the Democrats that live there.
I think you're right.
And that might have helped it be a little closer than it was. Still, I think Romney's feeling pretty good.
The other thing that happened in Wisconsin is the turnout was not as high as it has been in the past. Does that indicate that there's not a whole lot of enthusiasm for Republican candidates, or what does it indicate?
Well, you know, it's tricky. It depends on how you look at the turnout. Now, if you're just talking about the number of voters who voted in the Republican primary yesterday as compared to 2008. It actually was up. It was up a bit. But, you know, the thing that's interesting, and actually I write a weekly column now for the Wall Street Journal, and I'm doing something on this week. The turnout numbers have been, when you break them down through the way we look at them with Patchwork Nation, it's really interesting because what it seems is the places that have been strongest for Santorum, and again, it's these empty nests, these service worker centers, they actually have seen an increase in turnout in 2012 as compared to 2008. And these other communities where Romney, the wealthy moneyed burbs, are at the turnout is actually down a bit.
Really?
And yeah, and I'm not sure. I mean, we're going to have to look at what that really means going forward. But I think that there is this divide between Romney and Santorum is in many ways an urban-rural divide. And Romney is a candidate that will win or lose in November, really based upon what he does in the suburbs. That's what's going to define whether or not he wins or loses this campaign. And when you look at these turnout numbers, and he's winning those places against Santorum, but he should. What happens in the fall when he's got to win not just Republicans but independent voters in those places? These turnout numbers suggest to me he might have a little more of a challenge on his hands winning those places over.
I know you don't want us to look at large groups as large groups based on race or gender or whatever, but so much has been made of the gender issue and the polls showing that women are just not very happy with the Republican Party right now. Should we not look at gender this election?
No, oh, no, we should. But it's just, you got to keep in mind, I recently wrote this piece for the Washington Post actually talking exactly about what you're saying. And it's not that the so-called woman vote doesn't matter. My concern with saying things like that is that, you know, women make up, you know, 50%, a little more than 50% of the population. It's hard to talk about what the vote looks like among women. But I think the thing you can really say is among suburban, moderate women, the GOP has a big problem. And I have been a little surprised so far, anyway, that Romney, you know, his advisor got in trouble a couple weeks ago for, you know, talking about shaking the Etch-a-Sketch and, you know, moving on to the general election. But, you know, he actually does need to, shaking the Etch-a-Sketch is a horrible metaphor. Yeah, it's an awful metaphor, but he needs to do that. And I don't understand, now that he really has things wrapped up, he needs to start, in my opinion anyway, like, these are things like, I'm going to defund Planned Parenthood. Or he said even this week he's not really sure about global warming, you know, whether humans cause global warming. It's like, you know, there are people who believe that, but they're not in the suburbs. And if he wants to win, he's going to have to be careful what he says. And I'll tell you, he's going to have to move to the middle, and the sooner he does it, the better. And I'm not sure why he's not doing it quite yet.
Hmm. And what happened in the suburban vote in 2008, Dante?
It went heavily for Obama. You could really argue that Obama won the presidential election because of the places we call the moneyed burbs. In 2000, Al Gore won them by about 3 percentage points. In 2004, even though he lost because of the electoral vote. In 2004, John Kerry, who lost by more in the general election, won the moneyed burbs by 1 percentage point. So they're very close. Swinging, they split their vote very closely, but in 2008, Obama won them by 12 percentage points.
Oh my!
And that was really the election. In some ways, you could argue Romney is the perfect candidate for the GOP. You can't argue it in a lot of ways, but you can argue it in this way: that the conservative Republicans really don't like Obama. I mean, in some cases, you can definitely say they hate Barack Obama, and they're going to turn out for whoever. But the Republicans need to make inroads with moderates, and theoretically, anyway, Romney should be a good candidate for that. He's got some issues hanging out there, and we can talk about those as we go along. But he's definitely, of the field they had running, he's the best candidate to reach suburban voters.
And what's happened with suburban voters? I grew up in Illinois, and Illinois has become much more Democratic since I was a kid living in that area. But it's now much more Democratic. The state is, and the suburbs of Chicago are as well. Why?
Well, I think what's happened is the Republican Party has moved to the right. And I think that as it has moved to the right, it has a harder and harder time. I mean, on social issues in particular, social and cultural issues, like things like, you know, suburbanites tend to be very pragmatic. They're wealthier, first of all. They tend to be pragmatic. And when you talk to them about, you know, like the argument that for some reason the Republican Party got into about birth control, which I do not understand why they went there or what that argument was really even about.
Right.
But, you know, those issues are death to the party in the suburbs, because those are issues where it's, you know, they're pragmatic centrist voters for the most part. And when you start talking about issues like that, you turn them off. And I think over the last 30 years, the Republican Party has moved rightward. It's moved rightward, and it's turned off those moderate voters in the suburbs. It has also really become much more of a party that is against elites in Washington, and I would argue, I guess in Washington you could argue also like what you might call cosmopolitan or big city voters. And that has actually probably helped the GOP win some communities that are more rural in nature, and also just kind of have an inherent distrust of not just Washington, but of elites and more cosmopolitan voters around the country.
Would you agree, Dante, with Obama's statement this week that Ronald Reagan couldn't make it in the primary this year because he was not conservative enough?
That's an interesting concept. I don't know about that. It's impossible to say, you know, if the Reagan of 1980, yeah, he would have had a hard time. I mean, obviously he would have recalibrated his message for 2012, but he would have had a hard time. He really would have. And I think that, remember where the country was then, and he was conservative, you know, what seemed very conservative. I mean, the other way I was thinking about it, you go back further, you know, Nixon would almost certainly be a Democrat at this point. I don't know what he would have been in terms of what he would have classified himself as, but his positions, they would have looked very out of touch with where the GOP is right now.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated, and I'm so glad you wrote the piece about the issue of health care in 2012. It's a complicated issue. How does it play out? And let's go with one scenario, the whole thing becomes unraveled because of a Supreme Court decision, and then the other scenario that it's upheld.
Well, it gets very interesting when you... We looked at this last week in the piece I did for the Journal about whether or not... whether or not basically coverage rates, how covered people are in your county or your community, affect your opinion about the Obama health care plan. And we found looking at it that actually it really doesn't quite work that way. The wealthy suburbs tend to be more in favor of the Obama health care plan. Now, this is not breaking into individual pieces. When you break into pieces, most people do not approve. They don't want the mandate for coverage. But they tend to be much more in favor of the Obama health care plan. In fact, they favor it outright. Even though more people there have coverage. And then you go into some of these smaller communities and less wealthy communities where fewer people have coverage, and they actually tend to be opposed to the plan, which tells me, that the plan, the argument is really just about politics at this point. Very few people know what's in the plan, and people have lined up on various sides of it. I think the people in the moneyed burbs who do tend to be slightly more educated and probably follow the news more closely may be viewing it a little bit from a policy perspective. I will say, I think if it's thrown out outright, that's a bad thing for the Republican Party. If they just throw out the mandate, that could be a good thing for the Republican Party. It could be a bad thing for President Obama. I will say this, and this is my personal opinion. The American people, when it comes to health care, people may be upset about this, but they've got to grow up. They really have to grow up a little bit, because we've gotten to the point now where, you know, nobody likes the fact that health. First of all, some people say, like, I don't want the government interfering in health care. And it's like, okay, you don't. I understand that. And it's like, except, well, what do you think about pre-existing conditions? Like, oh, no, health insurance companies, that's not fair. They should have to cover people who are sick. They shouldn't just cover people who are healthy. It's like, well, first of all, then you are saying you want the government in health care, and not even talking about Medicare and Medicaid. But you are saying you want the government to get involved and regulate this. But the problem is, if you were going to, and everybody is in favor of the pre-existing condition aspect of this. Republicans are in favor of it. Covering people with pre-existing conditions has to happen. It's something we have to do. Fine. I think we should do that too, because I think it's true. It's unfair. But if you're going to say that these insurance companies have to cover sick people, but you're saying that you're saying that healthy people don't have to buy health insurance. But the problem is, I don't understand where people think, I mean, insurance premiums will go sky high. You're basically saying insurance companies have to cover sick people. Well, what's going to offset the cost of that? A other than your premiums. And it's like, when I look at the path that we're on with healthcare right now, the things we say we want and we don't want as a culture, we're headed toward a single payer plan anyway at some point. And it's, to me, if it gets thrown out completely, it's a problem for the Republicans, because they're going to have to quickly reenact things that are popular about it, like making sure that kids up to 26 can get coverage under their parents' plans. People like that. I mean, particularly adults like that, because they don't like the idea of their
right.
Kids
they do.
Toronto.
I think you're right.
The kids don't care, to be honest. A lot of the kids out of college simply don't care, but the parents care, because they know if something happens to the kid, it's going to be on them. So that's something they're going to want. They're going to want the pre-existing condition thing. You know, they're going to have to quickly work to enact some of this stuff, and it's going to put the GOP in a very odd situation if it's completely thrown out. If they just throw out the mandate, I don't know what happens. It kind of depends how the Obama team reacts to it, I suppose, in some ways.
And what about the position it puts the Supreme Court in? Have you done any examination of what people in all these communities think about the Supreme Court becoming involved in this very important and highly contentious issue?
No, that's a good question. We have not done that. In fact, we'd have to have polling data from somebody else that we can break down.
I see.
I'd love to look at that question. I do think that the way it would tend to break down is people in more conservative communities would tend to say that they are opposed to the Supreme Court getting involved in these things. Though I do think that when you look at it on an issue-by-issue basis again, when you look at the issues they care about, the attitudes will vary wildly. And people tend to think that the court is being too activist if they're doing something they don't like, and they tend to think the court
is
being just fine when they're not touching something they care about.
Right. So make sense of this. You wrote this: socially conservative evangelical epicenters, much higher numbers of uninsured, but right. They tend to disapprove of the plan by a wide margin, 55-40. How does that make sense?
Well, I mean, because to them, the way they see it is this is a power grab. I mean, it is interesting. The people in those evangelical epicenter communities are much more ideologically driven. I mean, it is to them, it's not a question of whether or not it would benefit, they would say anyway, it's not a question of whether it benefits me personally. It's about what's right and what's wrong. And I think this is wrong. That's what they'd say. Now, I also think if you break it apart and you say, again, do you think the health insurance company should have to cover people with pre-existing conditions? They'd say yes. You know, so it's, but when you take it at all, and again, it is the stamp that's been put on it, which is, you know, quote unquote, you know, Obamacare. They are so opposed to Obama. I mean, you could, you know, if you put Obama's name with pretty much anything, they're going to be opposed to it, because they have decided that, you know, Obama, for a host of reasons, is not their kind of guy, and they are going to oppose it.
Dante Cini is our guest this hour. He is a journalist, author of Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. We've talked with him on many occasions about that book and about how he has looked at the electorate all over the country. And instead of looking at red states, blue states, he's got 12 different communities, and people have different interests, different lifestyles in those communities, and tend to vote more in line with where you live than the state that you are a part of. He's also writing, I think he just said, once a week now for the Wall Street Journal, and we welcome phone calls for him. Here's how you reach us. He's written about, we can take all kinds of political questions. He, of course, was looking at all of the primaries, Wisconsin's being among the most recent. I think what he wrote about healthcare is extremely interesting, and he's written a number of other columns as well. Here's how you reach us if you'd like to. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And our lines are wide open for you. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, this is National Poetry Month, and we're going to talk about poetry. We should have a wonderful hour. Also, a request, we would like to have you do a little bit of poetry reading as well. Don't pick anything that's really, really long, because you know the problems with that. But if you have a poem that speaks to your heart that you would like to read, how often do you get a chance to read poetry on the radio. Today is your chance, so you may want to select a poem. And we'll hear from many people who are reading their own poetry. We'll hear from the Poet Laureate for the state of Wisconsin and with a professor of English and poetry in Michigan, who will look at the death of Adrienne Rich, an important poet who died last week. Dante Chinney is our guest now, and Dante is a journalist, has been for a number of years. We also should say, because he's really a Midwestern guy, his roots are firmly planted in the industrial Midwest, grew up outside Detroit, went to college at Michigan State University. Let's go to phone calls now, and we start with John. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you for the great show as always. And I was wondering for your guest. I was listening to what he had to say, and I was wondering, do you believe, either of you, for that matter, do you believe that the U.S. could ever split up into a few different countries because of the political tensions in the Midwest and even on the East and West Coasts? They're fairly different from each other.
What do you think, John, before we hear from Dante? Do you think that could happen?
You know, I've always thought to myself, why is Alaska part of the U.S.? they have so much for themselves. They would be better off by themselves or be better off part of Canada. Just a thought. maybe it could happen. But.
All right, Dante, what do you think?
Well, I mean, we tried this once, and it was...
We sure did.
The Civil War got pretty... is a horrible moment in U.S. history, but I would say that I actually think it's less likely that the U.S. will break apart now, and it's because, you know, and it's actually something I do with Patchwork Nation. The divides in the United States, and I know everybody still likes to talk about regions, and I'm from the Midwest, so it matters. Regions matter to me, but I do think increasingly as you travel around the country, the regions aren't as important as a kind of other socioeconomic demographic factors. And I do think it's, you know, the interesting thing I always explain to people or I talk about is, you know, if you live, you know, near a major metropolitan city and you get on an airplane and you land and you stay kind of close to another major metropolitan city, like maybe you fly from Milwaukee and you go spend some time in Chicago or Cleveland or even Philly, you know, it's not like it feels that different to you. You know, it really doesn't. I mean, yeah, the accents might be a little different, and, you know, obviously the rooting interests and sports are different. But when you get right down to it, I think that suburban Philly and suburban Milwaukee have a lot more in common with each other than say, suburban Milwaukee, and when you get out to some of the more distant counties of Wisconsin. And that's because what's happened in the country is we're increasingly divided by income levels, education levels, and as we do that, there are certain compounded by the fact that there are big kind of corporations that understand these divisions. The breakdowns are much more apparent to me when I travel, you know, from where I am in Washington. If I travel like 4 or 5 hours west from here, that feels much more different than going to suburban Philly. Which is, you know, let's put it this way, 2 hours west of here, and Philly is about 2 hours north of here. 2 hours west of here would feel a lot more different than 2 hours north of here, even though I'd be in a completely different state in a completely different area.
What about the South?
Yeah, I mean, the South is interesting, though. Even there, you know, Atlanta, they're obvious, the race is a different kind of issue down there. But, you know, go to suburban Atlanta. You know, is suburban Atlanta really that different from suburban Milwaukee or Chicago? I mean, some of it has to do with the size of the city when you get right down to it. You know, suburban Atlanta probably doesn't feel, you know, terribly different than suburban Chicago. I can't say I've been to the cities, I've been to the suburbs quite so much. But, you know, there are the similarities are about the kinds of people that decide they want to live or either decide or end up living in major metropolitan areas. I think that is the bigger dividing line in the United States now.
Thanks, John, for your interesting point. Let's go to Judy and Ripon. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I think your guest is brilliant. He hit the demographic descriptions on the head. She's really dead. I'm a registered nurse. I've been one for 30-some years, and I've worked in critical care for that many years. My husband's a family practice doctor who practices rural medicine. So we really do, I feel like I've got my finger on the pulse of what's happening. People that vote against Obamacare, you're right, they vote because they don't like Barack Obama. But what they don't understand is that 60% of the hospitals in the United States right now are religious or Catholic institutions. Because of the religious beliefs, we treat all comers. You treat people who are indigent and who can't pay. That can't go on forever. What happens is that as the sizable amount of people that are paying into the system shrinks, you have more people that can't pay being treated by hospitals that will take all comers. What happens then is that the hospitals will eventually have to close their doors. Patients are getting sicker as they're coming into the hospital now because they don't have the money to pay for their health care, so they wait longer, we're spending more. So that's why the Medicare bills are coming in so high. So what eventually happens is that you have the for-profit hospitals that are existing who can turn and do, even though they do find ways to work their way around the system, and even though there's an anti-dumping law, they do find ways, and that's a topic for another day. They do find ways to send them over to us working in the Catholic hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So when these hospitals close and there's for-profit hospitals only existing, people will die on their couches. That might not happen for another, I'd say, 20 years, but from the 1980s when DRGs and HMOs first came into existence and took competition out of the system, that too is another topic for another day, too long to lengthy to go into, there won't be an uproar or an outrage in this country as long as the majority can still get health care. And whether you can pay or not, in the end, when you're extremely ill and people are bringing you in a cart, you're still getting care from the Catholic hospital. You're not going to get it from the for-profit hospitals. You won't get cared for there. But until this reaches a critical mass of people not being treated, will they then look back and say, ooh, Barack Obama was right? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Judy. Dante.
Well, first, thanks for saying I'm brilliant. I wish my mom were listening. The other thing I'd say is your caller is right. And the thing that really compounds the problem is when you add in a kind of geographic and community element, when you have a community, because if you live in a big suburban area, a lot of people have insurance. And it is going to be about different hospitals being forced to take the ones that don't, but there are plenty of people that have insurance and they go to different hospitals that do, I guess. And then you also have university communities that really are completely different because university hospitals they just function differently. But when you get out to a small community where a lot of people don't have insurance, there's the question of whether or not the institution that takes care of people can survive. I go out, one of those places I travel for this project, and I go way out to Oregon, to Lincoln City, Oregon, and I've got a lot of people I know out there now. And they have a small hospital, Samaritan, I believe the number, I don't have it in front of me, I believe it was 60% of the people who come there have some kind of coverage, but 40% don't. So 40% of the people who come there, they call self-pay. That means that often it's no pay, because there's no insurance for them. They've got to treat those people. They're going to treat those people. And how do you pay for that? And what do you do in communities where a lot of people don't have health insurance? And we're getting more and more of those because of the shifts in the economy. Health insurance is increasingly not an option if you have, obviously if you don't have a part-time job, but contractor work, things like this, and people are taking a chance of not having health insurance. And eventually, I completely agree with, agree with the caller that, look, eventually the system's just going to break down. I don't know when it's going to happen either. But, if we don't do, the Obama plan, people can like it or hate it, but it was not as comprehensive maybe as it should have been. But it was a way to make the system work for a while longer at least. But, if you don't do this, you're just hastening. I just think it's just hastening. The system's going to collapse under its own weight. It's just a question of when.
Well, there are some people, Dante, who believe that the system already has collapsed, and thus we had all these laborious conversations about how to change the system. What's dumbfounding to me is that we can't, and I thought we tried to gather around the table and figure out where the problems are. We did that, and then come up with some kind of solution so that we can ensure more people, I think, was the number one goal. It's just incredible that we cannot move forward on this issue when it really affects people who are rich and poor and people who are uninsured and pre-existing conditions and hospitals and companies. Why can't we do this?
Well, it affects the poor a lot more, obviously. That's a big part of it. But I do think part of it is that Americans are still coping with the fact that the world has fundamentally changed. And, I think there is this debate even going on in this election now, in the 2012 election. It's like, we want to make America great. We want to make America what it was before. And, you know, I'll just tell you from traveling around the country and looking what's happening economically, you just want to tell people, look, that's just not going to happen. I mean, the world has fundamentally changed, and we're not going to be what we were before. We're not going to have what we were before. That doesn't mean that things are going to necessarily be awful, but it does mean that we have to start adjusting our expectations. And I think that what we have too much right now, and healthcare is a good example of it, the healthcare debate is a good example of it, is that, you know, again, like, well, I think everybody should have to be, I think the insurance company should have to cover everybody. But I also think that people shouldn't have to buy insurance. It's like, well,
right,
okay, if you do that, you're just hastening the collapse of the system, but fine. It's at some point, we just have to understand that we can't have what we once had because that's gone now. And I don't think we're there yet.
Tagger in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. You are brilliant, like butter. Anyway, I was going to say, first off, we need education reform because the voters can't add and subtract. But more importantly, I was going to ask your opinion on this statement. It seems, looking at the political process recently, the best way to sum it up would be, if you want someone to vote against their own interests, you just need enough money. What would be your comment on that?
That's increasingly a problem. I assume particularly you're talking about super PACs and things like that as well. You know, the thing the thing about the super PAC discussion and basically the Citizens United ruling for the Supreme Court, we're only seeing the beginning of this now. And all the focus is on the presidential race, which is going to be interesting, but there's a lot of money out there for that. The thing that's particularly interesting to me about Citizens United and is what happens in these small towns and small counties where basically one wealthy person, I mean, I guess it's always been true to some extent, but can really just buy an election outright now. It's fascinating. And I don't know if they're going to revisit the ruling at some point, but it fundamentally changes politics.
Yes,
it does.
The way
politics works. It's really, we've never seen anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, this is just the beginning. It's going to be developing over the next, next couple of elections. I guess it's particularly the next decade. And what it's going to look like, I just don't know.
The recall race has started in earnest, and you could tell where the money is now because the commercials are just omnipresent. And one side has a lot more money, you can tell, than the other, because they're running ads against, well, this particular candidate would be this kind of disaster, this particular candidate would be this kind of disaster, without even a candidate from the Democratic side. They've got all bases covered. It's just weird.
That is sadly the nature of politics now. And, you know, I do feel for you guys up there. That recall election, that's basically, you guys have basically had a nonstop election now for the last, it's 18 months.
You're right.
Going on 2 years. It's been fascinating for us that don't live in Wisconsin to watch it, but I was there a bit last summer, and it's just, you guys are really trapped
right.
in like a never-ending
right.
campaign right now.
We are, I know. You're right. Thank you for commiserating. Tiger, thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Peter in Sauk City. Hi, Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Oh, hi. Yeah, well, first thing, I think Mr. Kennedy, or President Kennedy, started buying elections back in 1960. I don't think it's some new phenomenon. But secondly is that, you know, I'm talking about being in different parts of the country. You know, you being a conservative like in Dane County, you know, I wouldn't even feel comfortable going into court in Dane County anymore because of the supposedly nonpartisan positions judges have, and how they run things. It's a bad place to be. And if you don't agree with the majority in a county, you can't get a fair shake in the judge systems. And it seems like when I listen to the folks on this radio station, that if you don't agree with the progressive movement in Wisconsin, well, you're stupid. You vote against your own interests. You don't understand politics. You don't understand how horrible things are. And I think what we should do is take a look at what Canada did. you know, when they went to the single-payer system, it's a fascinating story about how they were so happy to have it. Everybody was for it, all the editors up there, all the newspapers. And then after they had it for 4 or 5 years, all the apologies that were out there from these folks saying, yeah, I'm from Canada, we have great health insurance.
All right, Peter.
And nothing else.
Yeah, let's talk about the American system for a moment. Do you think that there are problems in America?
And they were able to, pardon me?
Do you think there are problems with health care in this country?
Oh, absolutely. And I think if it was more open to a market system where if I wanted to go in and have a physical, I could say, well, here's what it costs for a physical at this clinic, and this clinic. You know, make it more free market. Don't make it, you know, tell us how much it costs. Let us go out and buy it.
All right, Dante.
Well, and I guess if he's still there, is he still there? He's gone.
He's here. He's definitely here.
The thing I'm curious about is, you know, it's the single payer system. The numbers don't add up. If you believe, I mean, do you believe that people who have pre-existing conditions should be able to get coverage, affordable health insurance?
Peter? Oh, Peter's gone.
I mean, because to me, that's the question. It's not a question of, to make clear, it's like the people who are opposed to the Obama health care plan have all sorts of reasons for it. I'm not saying they're stupid or anything like that. But the one thing I am saying is that I just think you have to make choices as a society. And as a society, we have to make choices, some choices about health care. If you think that people who have pre-existing conditions should have to be covered, I think that's great. If you think that kids who are, 26 and kids, people who are 26 and under
their kids
should be able to be on their health care, their parents' health care, that's great too. Those things cost money. And, I just feel my problem is not that one side's right or one side's wrong or one side's stupid and one side's not. My problem is that as Americans, we still think we can have it all. And I've made this point on your show several times before, but look, we lived through this post-World War II period, and we just thought that was normal. Like, this is just the way things are going to be forever now. And it's just not. The world has fundamentally changed, and we don't run the world anymore. And that doesn't mean that things are necessarily going to be awful or, oh, America's in decline and things are just going to be crappy forever now. It doesn't mean that. But it does mean that the way we did things before doesn't work. And we have to start making some honest-to-God choices about what we're going to do. And that's my biggest problem with what's going on in the country now.
And what about his point, which I think is a significant one, that he feels that he can't go to Dane County because they're all liberal judges and he won't get a fair shake? And there are liberals who feel that you can't go to the Supreme Court because they're conservative judges. I mean, what's this all about?
I think that's very true. And I think the Supreme Court issue is different because it is really – because that becomes a fight about – what we're going to do with the president and how much the Supreme Court becomes an issue in the presidency. But when you get down to these local court levels, he makes a really interesting point. And I think there are probably liberals that feel the same way about being in certain counties around the country as well. And, you know, to some extent, I think that's always been there. I think, you know, we've always had, you know, that's why we allow municipalities to run their own school systems, right? Because we feel that there should be some differences that take into account what the community thinks about things, and that's good. But what's happening is the country is just we're going in different directions now. I think we had a moment again in the post-war era where the country was kind of headed more in the same direction, and the splintering of media and the changing economy and then really the creation of more winners and losers in the U.S. economy. Straight out instead of everybody just really being a winner, is going to heighten these divisions again. And it's going to make it actually more like it was many, many, many years ago. And it's just, I don't know what it's going to mean. I just think it's going to be fascinating. As a journalist, it's just going to be a fascinating thing to watch unfold. I don't know what it's going to mean.
Dante Chinney is our guest this hour, journalist, author of Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our lines are filled, but eventually there will be a chance for you to get through. You can use the email, too. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this morning. This is National Poetry Month, and we'll be celebrating the month. We'll be hearing selections from Nikki Giovanni, Langston Hughes, Seamus Heaney, many other poets. We'll have a couple guests with us. Wisconsin's poet laureate Bruce Dethelfson will be with us. And we will also speak with Linda Gregerson, a poet, a critic, and English professor at the University of Michigan, who will be remembering the life of Adrienne Rich, who died last week. We're also asking if you have a poem, not too lengthy, please, because we want to play a lot of poems and hear from a lot of people, but this is a chance for you to read a poem for us and celebrate National Poetry Month, so our phone lines will be open for you as well. Back to phone calls for Dante Chinney. Carl in Boulder Junction. Hello, Carl.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Since I've been listening on hold here, I did want to add a comment when he was talking about the economy, and it's not going to be back the way it was. And now you still hear people saying nowadays in America, I want my children to have things better than I had. And that just leaves me shaking my head because they have two cars, a boat, all the toys, and it's almost delusional. What more could you want? But originally I called because I wanted to ask Dante his opinion on what he thought and when and why the word moderate and moderation became a dirty word. And it seems like the people used to see as a fringe element, the radicals, and a lot of it is the religious right and even the far left. They seem to be running the show, and that just really is disillusioning to me, and I would appreciate his comments on that. And thanks for a great show.
Thanks, Carl.
I tell you, it's disillusioning to us too. I think, and by us I mean the journalists and journalists in this town who have to cover it, who have to cover Washington. What's happened? I mean, I think a couple things have happened. I do think the way things have been districted, particularly at the House level. District and redistricted, and you end up with very strong voices from the far left and the far right, but not a lot in the middle. And that's a shame. The other thing that's happened, I think, is, again, I just think that the country is going through a very dramatic change right now, your caller's point is really excellent about the two boats, or the two cars and a boat, and a life that was just a function of a particular moment in U.S. history that I think is gone now. But I think that as we go through this understanding that the stuff is gone, the reaction is that kind of people draw off into different camps. And I do think that at some point and start, you know, making accusations against each other and thinking that their way is the right way and it's the only way to fix what's going on, because when people get nervous about what's happening, they retreat into ideology. I do think that happens. I do think at some point you come out of it, and people say, well, you know, this just isn't working, and we're going to have to find some way to fix these things. But I just think we're not there yet. And I do think we shouldn't expect that to happen too fast. I think the next couple elections are going to be like this. They're going to be people from both sides really yelling and trying to, from the far left and far right, steering things in certain directions. And it's going to get, and this is an awful thing to say, but I think it's going to actually get worse before it gets better. It's going to get even weirder. The political debate is going to get weirder in the next decade.
Oh, that's terrible, because we should be demanding something else.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's a function of the uncertainty in the air and people wanting, you know, everybody wants everything to, again, you know, the debate right now is, you know, can't we just go back to be what we were before? And, you know, you just want to tell people, you know, it's like, no, we can't, because we don't live in that world anymore, and we have to. The sooner we face the fact that the world has changed, the sooner we can get around to trying to make the adjustments we need to.
Nate in Appleton. Hi, Nate.
Yeah, one of the things that I find amusing is the Republicans try and blame Democrats for the deficits. There's just some basic misunderstanding about the reality of supply-side economics. Between 1980 and 1980, the economy grew at 0.733%. Neither Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, or George W. Bush got, even as an average for their term, to that level. So it is a historical fact that supply-side economics did not deliver higher growth rates. Bill Clinton created more jobs in 8 years than the Republicans did in 20. It did not create jobs. What it did create was gigantic deficits. And if the spending ratios and taxing ratios of Bill Clinton had been kept, we would have paid off the entire national debt, not the deficits, the whole debt, 2 years ago. So it is simply an economic fact that Republican supply-side economics has led to lower growth, lower job creation, and huge deficits, and doubling down on it.
Dante.
Well, I think there are some things to keep in mind. I mean, we would not have continued on the path we were on during the Clinton administration for a host of reasons, and one of them is, you know, we would have had a decline in revenues just because the recession happened, and it would have happened. Because some of that boom we got in the Clinton years, particularly toward the end of the Clinton years, was due to the dot-com boom that eventually went bust. And, you know, the other thing I'd say is once after 9/11 happened, something – now, Iraq didn't have to happen, and a lot of people would point that out, but something would have happened. There would have been some money spent on defense. I don't know if we would have spent as much as we did under Bush, under somebody else, but something would have happened. And I'm not saying this – all I'm saying is that it's easy to take the projections and just project forward what would have happened, but, you know – you know, life is what happens when you're busy making plans. You know, things get in the way, and it's hard to say that. Now, that said, I do think that, you know, there are good arguments to be made for the fact that supply side economics really didn't yield what it did to the deficits was bad. It really was. You can definitely argue that it did explode the deficits in some way, but what really blew it up over the last 10 years has been, first of all, the money we spent fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then second of all, look, when this recession hit, a lot of this debt we have now, you know, like, look, we had to, I know that people didn't like, some people don't like the stimulus, and we can have lots of debates about that, but something had to be done. I think people forget how close we were to the precipice. I mean, we were going over the edge. Money had to be spent. And, you know, some of these things like, you know, we shouldn't have saved the auto industry because we could have gotten private financing for it. There was no private financing. It's amazing how short our memories are. How scary things were in the spring of 2009. They were terrifying.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. Nate, thanks for the call. Nick in Greenfield, hi.
Yes, hello. And thank you for a very good intuitive program. What I was calling about is that the way that the younger people who are healthy now feel that they don't need insurance now. But someday they will. An affordable health plan, if they buy insurance now, the affordable health plan that everybody calls Obamacare, it says either buy insurance now or pay it into a fine at the end with your taxes. Actually, what you should look at is that they would be paying into the system now, like putting money into a savings account for future use.
Mm-hmm. Like Social Security.
Sooner or later, they're going to have to use it.
Mm-hmm. Dante.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing is, you know, the argument is that, well, they just want to buy catastrophic coverage. They feel that that's all they should have just in case they get in a car accident or something like that. You know, and it's just a question we have to ask ourselves at some point. It's like, look, we all live together in this society, and if we want to make insurance affordable for somebody, do we just have to say you have to buy it? Now, the question before the Supreme Court is whether or not you can compel people to buy health insurance. There is no question as to whether or not you can tax them. And I'm just saying, and this is not about ideology. I'm just saying, look, at some point, you're going to have to find a way to pay for the system. Right now, we're not paying for the system, and premiums are going to go up and up and up. And it's something. It's going to happen anyway. I'm just telling you. I think it's going to happen anyway.
Thanks, Nick. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. I think your guest has alluded to this. I think that the big problem is that a lot of folks, I'm a Democrat and quite far to the left, but I think that the other side simply wants something for nothing. They do not want to have to pay for the services that they demand.
Well, maybe. I think when it comes to like the mandate, so many people are opposed to that. I mean, pretty much everybody's opposed to that, and it's if you ask them, I mean, I think in the community types we've looked at, I think there was maybe one, maybe the big cities were not opposed to it. I think every other community type I looked at in Patchwork Nation, using a Pew poll, said they were opposed to the individual mandate. So it extends. I mean, the problem is everybody wants to pay, because from liberals you heard, like, I don't want a dollar of mine to go to this war effort. It's like, you live in the U.S. That's a decision. You like it or not, that's a decision that's been made. You can't do that. And so I think a lot of times, I think even both sides, there are things that we feel comfortable paying taxes for the things we believe in. We don't feel comfortable paying taxes for the things we don't believe in. And the thing we have to accept is we all live in this country together, so your taxes are going to go to some things you don't like. And I think the caller's right about that. I think it does extend to both sides of the aisle too often.
You mentioned earlier that you thought a public option was down the road. Considering what was said in the whole long, long, long debate about a public option a couple of years ago, what makes you think that that's going to be what we get to eventually, and when do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I don't even think it's a public option. I think it'll be a single payer. It'll be a single payer plan, and we're gonna get there at some point, just because the finances won't work. We want stuff that we can't have. Mm. You can't cover all the sick people and not have a way to pay for them without premiums going sky high. And at some point, premiums get to the point where people say that, you know, well, this isn't acceptable. And they may hate the idea of a single payer plan. Now, I don't even know if they know what it really means. I think it would depend on how you constructed it, obviously. But, you know, I think at some point they just say, like, well, I don't like that, but what I have now I can't afford. And it is. You reach a tipping point to there are so many people that don't have insurance where it's just where you're going to end up. And I think eventually it's going to happen because we're spending too much now. The system, the numbers don't add up.
No, it's way too much. I'm with you. Dante, thank you so much for being with us. We'll chat again as this year goes on.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. Dante Chinney. George, thanks for your call. Our guest, he is the author of Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. And he writes extensively. You see him on PBS frequently. He also has a weekly column now in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production. Here in our studios in Milwaukee, we'll have news coming up, and then let's celebrate National Poetry Month. All right.